From Colorado Public Radio, I'm Ryan Warner, and this is Colorado Matters. Today, we wrap up our conversations with the primary candidates in the race for U.S. Senate. Both parties hold primaries August 10th. Our guest is Republican Jane Norton. She's running against Weld County District Attorney Ken Buck, who was on yesterday. Norton, who's 55, was Colorado's lieutenant governor from 2003 to 2007. Early on, she seemed like a shoo-in to win the Republican primary, but it has turned into a tough fight. Jane Norton, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And before we get into specific areas of policy, I want to ask a question of you that we've been asking of all the candidates. Let's say you're in an elevator and you meet a Republican wearing a Ken Buck button. With time for just a quick chat, how do you convince him or her that you have the better chance of beating the Democratic Senate candidate come November?
Well, first of all, I would thank the person for choosing a candidate and being involved. You know, that's one of the most exciting things that we're seeing is people are energized. But I would talk about my experience, my record of cutting budgets, and talk about the importance of winning in November, and I'm the one that can do it.
The importance of cutting budgets. Expound just a little bit on that for me. What bullet points you might highlight for that person?
People are extremely concerned about the fact that we are mortgaging our children's and grandchildren's future. I hear continually from Colorado voters that the type of deficit and the $13 trillion debt that we're leaving our kids right now is just unacceptable. And I've had two budgets entrusted to me by the taxpayers of Colorado, one when I was head of the state health department and one when I was lieutenant governor. In both of those instances, my general fund appropriation was smaller when I left than when I started. So that's a record of being a careful spender of tax dollars and, in fact, cutting budgets. And that, I believe, is the single most important issue that people want to hear about.
We're going to talk more about the federal deficit and how you would approach cutting it. But let me ask you about your greatest policy difference with Ken Buck.
My positive transportation solutions. Ken, when asked about the I-70 corridor, says it's not the federal government's business, and that's just naive. We collect federal fuel tax dollars to the tune of 18.3 cents per gallon, and then we ship it back to Washington, and for every dollar that we ship back, we only get 92 cents back. So I've called for us to collect the fuel tax, but keep it in Colorado and let our bipartisan Colorado Transportation Commission decide what the priorities are and then use the dollars here rather than just getting back 92 cents on every dollar. And what happens, Ryan, is that additional money goes to other states or goes to the Congress for earmarks, which I believe is absolutely the wrong thing to do. I was the first one in the Senate race to say I will not seek or support earmarks. I think that's an important pledge. But let me talk about how, I mean, the over 6 years, that collecting and keeping in Colorado would account for $500 million. So it's a substantive amount of, you know, we could do a lot with that. We could get a halfway through another tunnel at Eisenhower Pass. So it's a significant amount of money.
Let's talk about the deficit government spending. The country is grappling with a $13 trillion deficit. One pressing issue is whether to extend unemployment benefits for people who've been out of work for a long time. The bill for that nationally would be $33 billion. Supporters of extending the benefits say if those folks have that money, they'll spend it. That'll help the economy. Opponents say that the federal government can't afford it anymore, and they point to the deficit. What's your view on re-extending these benefits?
Well, certainly the 15 million people out of work need help. Government doesn't create jobs. It's the private sector that creates jobs. If I had the opportunity to vote on unemployment benefits being extended, I would insist that we have offsets in other portions of the budget, and that's not what we're seeing now.
And so where would those offsets be?
Well, we have to have a serious discussion about balancing the budget without raising taxes, and I have a multiple point plan for doing that. I would take each and every dollar that's not been spent on stimulus and TARP and put it down towards the budget deficit with demands that it not be used to fund any additional programs. And then I say what we need to do is cut discretionary spending by 20%. That only gets us to 2009 levels. So we need to start somewhere, and I think cutting discretionary spending is absolutely key.
A question about that.
Sure.
Jane, discretionary spending in some ways is a small part of the federal budget.
Yes.
So much of the federal budget is dictated by military spending, Social Security, Medicare, for example.
Well, that's another portions of my plan, and before we get to the entitlements, because that's where the real money is, I would say repeal Obamacare. It's one of the largest taxes on American working families, and replace it with substantive health care reform that will bring the cost down. Don't pass cap and trade. Pass a comprehensive energy policy with all of the above approach. Now, Social Security and Medicare. We have a $3.5 trillion federal budget. Two-thirds of that fully is in our entitlement programs. So if we're really serious about balancing the budget without raising taxes, we have to look at how can we reform Social Security and Medicare. And this is another difference between Ken Buck and myself. Ken Buck has said that Social Security is a terrible, horrible policy. I believe it's a sacred trust with our seniors, and we need to ensure that it is solvent for generations to come.
Would you raise the retirement age, do you think?
I would. For people who are near retirement, 55 and above, I would not do that because they don't have enough time to adjust. But for people coming into the system, certainly because of the demographics, we're living longer. It makes sense to me, as we did in the 80s, to slightly and gradually increase the retirement age. So that's one of the things we could do. Secondly, we could look at the automatic cost of living increases. We could also look on the Medicare side of perhaps means testing for wealthy Americans on Medicare so that they would pay a portion of their health care.
There is a quote from you of calling Social Security a Ponzi scheme. What did you mean by that?
Well, in a Ponzi scheme, you have people paying in, and then you're paying to other people, and the benefits aren't accruing to the original investors to the extent that they should. Listen, Social Security is an important promise to the elderly, and it's one that we need to keep. But most people think that they pay into Social Security, and it's somehow this lockbox. But in fact, the trust fund is utilized for other components of the budget, for incredible programs that don't have anything to do with those original investors, if you will, or the folks paying in. So in that regard, it's a Ponzi scheme, and it's one that we have to reform in order to ensure that it is solvent for future generations.
You've brought up a lot of different issues. We're going to address many of them coming up. Let me ask you about a cut that you have discussed in public, and that is eliminating the Department of Education.
Right.
Tell me about why you believe that's a good route.
Well, I do believe that we are at a time in our nation's history where the debate is really about what is the proper scope and size of the federal government. And you look at the Constitution, nowhere in the Constitution is education mentioned. So my plan is actually to block grant the money from the Department of Education to the states and let them have choice and competition. We know education funding at the federal level has gone up over 30 years, but student performance has remained relatively flat. So that's what my plan would be, to block grant the money to the states. I'm for vouchers, charter schools, things that give parents and students choices and competition. We know that works in education achievement.
You've also called for a national equivalent to Colorado's Tabor Amendment, the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, which requires public votes on tax increases, limits spending to the combination of inflation plus population growth. What would that look like nationally?
Well, I don't believe that government should grow faster than the private sector. And that's basically what our Taxpayers' Bill of Rights says here in Colorado. And I do like the part that says that citizens should have a vote when their taxes are increased. If we had Tabor at the federal level, we certainly wouldn't be seeing the incredible kinds of spending that we're seeing by the Congress right now.
You backed in 2005 Referendum C, which was a Tabor timeout. Isn't that in some ways an acknowledgement that a Tabor-like piece of legislation has its weaknesses?
Well, I believe that Ref C is Tabor in action. It allowed the people of the state of Colorado to vote on a timeout, which was moot actually the last 2 years because the surplus wasn't there because of the recession. So I like the component that says people have a say whether in their tax increases. So I think that that's an important element of Tabor.
Let's break apart some of the other potential savings and changes that you mentioned. What you call Obamacare, health care reform is something that you would dismantle. But you've said that that's not likely to happen in the near future. How would you approach changing that if elected to the Senate?
I do think it can be repealed, certainly not in 2010 when you have a president who could, you know, use his veto pen on anything that the Congress would do. And certainly I'm watching the constitutional challenge that our Attorney General Southers here in Colorado is one of 15 other attorneys generals across the nation to say, is it constitutional for the federal government to mandate purchase of a private product? And I don't think it is. So that's an important challenge. And if I were in the Congress, I would not fund discrete programs like the 16,500 IRS agents that are envisioned if Obamacare is fully implemented. So there are things on the legal challenge and on the appropriation side. But look, nobody believes that our system presently is working.
And that's my question for you.
Yeah.
So in lieu of what is in law now, what do you do for someone who does not have insurance today? What's your approach?
Well, what I would like to see is how do you bring the cost of health care down so that people will be able to purchase it? And I don't believe that fines and penalties are the way to go. One of the things that we know is a driver of health care that brings the cost up are junk lawsuits and defensive medicine. So let's have a serious look at tort reform. Let's talk about portability. If I lose my job, if I lose my job and go to another job or change jobs, I can't take my health care with me. Why not be able to purchase across state lines? That would bring choice and competition into the market, and I believe those would be things that would bring the cost of health care down.
Former Lieutenant Governor Jay Norton is with us. She's running for U.S. Senate against Weld County District Attorney Ken Buck in the August 10th Republican primary. As she alluded to before the break, she does not believe government should play a role in regulating carbon through a so-called cap-and-trade program.
I believe that cap-and-trade is an extremely onerous tax on American working families. So what I would prefer, along with technologies, along with conservation, is an all-of-the-above approach. Because right now, America gets 85% of its energy from coal, gas, and oil. We need to get at that at an effective way that protects the economy. And as we look at alternative fuels, such as nuclear, that we have an all-of-the-above approach. We can do it clean. We can do it in a way that protects the environment, and we must for our national security.
On this subject, one of the biggest controversies over drilling in Colorado is the Roan Plateau on the western slope. The feds have leased some of that land for drilling. Environmentalists are suing. Does this state need the Roan's energy?
I think it does. I think it needs Anwar. It needs Roan.
Anwar in Alaska.
Anwar in Alaska,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Alaska, yeah. Because, and Roan, again, on the western slope where I am from, is an important field, and the surface disturbance can be minimum. And I believe we should be drilling on the Roan in an environmental protective way.
Are you pleased with how it's been done so far on the Roan?
Well, I believe that there can be much more done in that regard. I believe the administration should accept Colorado's roadless rule, and we need to get on with drilling there.
When you say that there's a lot more that could be done there, do you mean more drilling or more in the way of environmental protections?
More drilling. Permits have been slow to come, and I would like to see more of that land open up for responsible drilling.
Would you tap Colorado's oil shale reserves?
Yes.
How soon do you believe that could happen? What do you make of the research on its viability?
I believe that the technology in recent years has shown that oil shale can be viable. I would like to see that technology utilized in, again, environmentally responsible ways that help us with energy security.
I want to talk to you about immigration. You have said flatly no amnesty for folks who are illegally in the country. What happens to the people, estimates generally run about 12 million, who are here illegally? What do you do with them, and what are the resources for that?
Well, and I've always said that first and foremost, we have to secure our borders. That's our number one issue. I've also said we need a temporary worker program so that our employers know that the people that they want to hire are here on a temporary basis and they're here truly legally. Those needs should be predicated on the needs of our economy. I think if we have those two issues in place, I think a lot will take care of itself, and people will need to go outside of the state perhaps and come back in a legal way. And it's the federal government that needs to be taking this on head on, and they haven't done it.
So is it your sense that if those programs are in place, the millions and millions who are here just naturally leave, or what?
Well, I do think a lot of that will happen, absolutely. If they know that the United States government is serious about having a secure border and taking on the illegal immigration issue, that I do believe a lot of that will take care of itself.
Surely there will be some illegal immigrants who don't naturally leave on their own. What do you suggest the government do with
them?
Well,
some of the Hispanic clergy have said, and I think it's an interesting idea, is that if they wanted to stay, that they would go to law enforcement and say, "I am here illegally," and they would receive punishment and they would have a record, and they would go to the back of the line, they would submit themselves to a background check, and then they would go to the back of the line.
They would not be deported necessarily?
Well, they could be. They could be if they didn't pass a background check or if they had infractions that would be troublesome. The other thing is that right now they could face up to a 30-day imprisonment, and of course we don't have enough jail room if all would come forward to this. So one of the suggestions is then they do 30 days of community service. So I think it's an interesting option, but I do believe right now that barring some kind of solution like that, that they would have to leave the country.
I want to ask you a political question. The Buck campaign says you're part of the Washington establishment, that you've taken PAC money, you've got family members back there who are prominent lobbyists. That's a refrain that we've heard frequently from his campaign. But what do you say to that?
Well, I always have to chuckle, Ryan, when I hear that, because Ken Buck, and he's a good guy, and I respect him, but he has been a government attorney since 1988. He's been in the system. His wife was the vice chairman of the Republican Party for 8 years. You know, I'm in the private sector. I go in and I serve, and then I go back into the private sector. I mean, I've been a school teacher. I've managed nonprofits. It's, I mean, I think it's smart to try to paint somebody as an insider, but the fact of the matter is people from all around the nation are interested in this race in Colorado. And just like people here in Colorado gave money to Scott Brown, we're getting people interested in my candidacy because they know I can win and Ken can't.
Scott Brown in Massachusetts.
In Massachusetts, yeah, right.
I want to end on a personal note. Can you tell us about the first time, maybe it was when you were very young, that it occurred to you that government, for better or for worse, could have an impact on your life?
Oh, that's a great thought. Many, many times, obviously, as an adult. But I think...
Take your time.
One of the times that I can remember was I was a student, a swimmer, and we had a swim program, and it was all volunteers, typically guys from the community. I know my dad was in the Lions Club, and it struck me that here are all these moms and dads that were volunteering their time to help us as young people, and it wasn't the government. It wasn't the city of Grand Junction saying, you know, you need to do this. And that's really what struck me is the fact that we have this incredible group of citizenry who understand the importance of coming alongside young people and helping them, and it's not the government.
Jay Norton, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Jay Norton was Colorado's lieutenant governor from 2003 to 2007. She faces Ken Buck, the Weld County District Attorney, in the GOP senatorial primary August 10th. Listen to our conversation with Buck and with the two Democrats from earlier in the week at cpr.org. And a reminder that we'll re-air these conversations as part of a two-hour special this weekend, Saturday evening at 7 and Sunday afternoon at 1.